Good afternoon, my friends, and welcome to this special presentation of Cowboy State Politics. As we all know, I've been on a hiatus for a week, so I thought I needed to give you something to chew on. Yesterday, my pals Joey Carrente and Representative Ken Pendergraft recorded another episode of Crosstalk Live, so I thought I'd play it for you. It's the first time we're all back in the studio and ready to go on the Independence Network. To listen to the Independence Network, go to independencenetwork.us. In addition to the radio station, there's also an articles section to the website. You'll find op-eds and pieces by conservatives all across the state of Wyoming. Coming on tomorrow's edition of Cowboy State Politics, I have an interview with candidate for House District 51, Lori Bratton. The cowpie has been hammering her pretty hard in the last couple of days, but here's the thing. Most of what they're saying isn't true, or at the very least, it's not accurate at all. And there's a couple of articles out where the Wyoming caucus is saying we should only listen to politicians that were born right here in the state of Wyoming. Their argument might work if a whole bunch of members of the Wyoming caucus were actually born in the state of Wyoming. I'll give you a hint. Two of their main guys, they weren't born here either. And if that weren't enough, there seems to be a little bit of controversy about how much money we spent in the budget session. The cowpie first reported that that number was $10.6 billion. Rumor has it that Trotsky Wolfson was listening to Slithers a little bit too much. Then they reported that that number was actually $11.1 billion, without any acknowledgement whatsoever that they got the first number wrong. But the truth is, it's not 11.1 either. It's a lot higher than that. As it turns out, when you pass legislation that spends money, and I know that this will come as a complete surprise to all of you, but that's also spending money. A pretty good indication that a redcoat is lying is that their lips are moving, and that goes for their acolytes in the Wyoming media also. So to say the least, there's a lot of stuff that's going to happen tomorrow on Weekend Update. You don't want to miss a second of it. So before we get back on schedule tomorrow, here's the episode of Crosstalk Live that me and the boys recorded last night.
It's Crosstalk Live.
Welcome to another episode of Crosstalk Live. We finally got Ken back. Ken, welcome.
Can I come out now?
And of course, we have Joey Carrente.
As long as it's not out of the closet, Ken.
No, they'll never get me shut in the closet.
How's things in Saratoga, Joey?
Well, they're interesting. We had a little bit of weather down here, and it affected some of the internet and utilities, but we're back up and running, and got to say, I'm happy to be home, and you were right. My first session down there, I took a shower every day. I took a sitting in the bath, which I haven't done in decades.
I hope you had one of them back scrubbing brushes to get the nooks and crannies.
I did. I went out and got one of those straps. Not quite a loofah, but yeah, got all of it. And then when I got home, I think I've gone through about a 5-gallon bucket of degreaser and I'm Italian, so I'm used to being greasy, but not Cheyenne greasy.
You know, I got to tell you guys, last session was 2 months long. I was pretty well still good to go after a month. I mean, it's still Cheyenne, it's still a swamp, still irritatingly dishonest. And I didn't feel near as bad last session as I did this one. After about 3 weeks, I was ready to come home.
It was pretty intense. Some people I remember looking up into the gallery for a little bit of support and realizing he's gone. Some people didn't quite make it all the way through.
Nope.
I was a little jealous.
Friday, I was out of there, man.
Yeah, there were a couple of days when it was all I could do to stay in there and not scream.
Well, we certainly don't envy you.
Yeah, and going through a session like that made me realize it's a lot like the Army. It's not the years, it's the miles.
Exactly.
So even in a 20-day session, it takes it out of you. And you know, David and I were just extremely active spectators is what I'm going to call it. But still, to watch some of these things happen and go through the process, quote unquote, still makes me sick to say that word. And then watch them disregard it and play some of their games and use the calendar against the intent, and it's really sick. And I thought I knew something about politics and legislation, and I still have so much to learn. So if you're sitting out there and you think, well, you know, I know enough. Hey, nobody does. I think even Ken can say from the floor, you're still learning stuff, and you've been on the floor for 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah. You're still learning stuff. The learning curve is probably more like 6 to really get proficient at it. But I got to say, in some ways, I think you guys had it tougher, because at least down there, I could get up and say something.
Yeah.
I had a voice. And you guys up there, are your hands are tied. And I could tell, I'd look up sometimes, and David, he'd be like biting his lip and text me, what is it that you want to get out? And sometimes he would. And fortunately, most of the time, I think somebody picked up on whatever he was getting at. But it would have to be frustrating to be able to just say this.
It is. It's really difficult. The biggest frustration for me is you hear things that are just patently untrue. And, you know, they're down on the floor and somebody goes to the microphone and, you know, they don't let you bring any evidence. You can't bring a book up there and say, well, according to this author, everything you say is a bunch of bull crap. Yeah. They won't let you do that.
So no props.
Yeah. Everything down there, it seems like, at least from the gallery, that you guys are taking it all as gospel, even though some of it, you know, is just patently not true.
Well, I'll tell you another thing that is hard is while you're down there, you hear something and it triggers a response. And so you begin mentally working, mulling over how to present that, you know, how to present your argument or how to say what it is to say. And while you're doing that, you may miss 2 or 3 things. And then you stand up there and you say what you say, and the discussion has gone beyond. And that's kind of a scary trap at times. And everybody falls into it. Even the old guys do that.
I'll give a small, I guess, piece of advice. I love to do this when I'm on the floor on the Republican Party side. I saw a few times a couple legislators did it, but develop the ability to pose your accusations in the form of a question. And I watched some people do that masterfully a couple times. And I got to tell you, it is tough sitting up there in the gallery and keeping your mouth. I only broke once, and that was near the very end. Bill Lannon stood up to argue against House Bill 125, and he retold his story about how he was involved in a school shooting. And I let it out under my breath. I'm like, it was a bow and arrow, biscuit head. And of course, Sarah Burlingame was sitting right over my shoulder like she was half the session. Decided to say very loudly, you need to be quiet. You're not allowed to talk. And I let her know very quickly that I would take it under advisement, but I don't work for her. So anyway, and as far as props, on, that's what got me at the very end was no props on the floor is a standing rule. And they'll call you out even in the gallery if you're wearing something that's a little too much of an advertisement or a political slogan. And then our dear governor, Go Green Gordon, comes in with the biggest prop of them all right at the end and makes a joke about
dollars.
$1 billion tie, ha ha, we robbed you, Wyomingites.
It is, yep. Gordon, so yeah, I could believe that he did that, but I was irate when I watched it. I mean, making fun of $1 billion that was blown, that there was no reason for it.
Not in my mind, except for maybe the $75,000 for some mammoth jacks. I was a little disappointed that one didn't make it.
Well, Joey, how many bills are sitting on Governor Gordon's desk right now?
Well, by last count, I think it's in excess of 50, not quite 60. So I'll just say 55 to be safe. He did sign 2 bills today that really don't do anything, but he hasn't signed a bill in a week. And, you know, the process is the process. He has to sign a bill within 3 days while the session is open. But those last 3 days of the session are kind of a gimme, because by the end of the 3 days, session will be closed. So he has 15 days to sign them. So by this time next week, he will have had to make some kind of statement on these other 55 bills. But all he's signed since session is closed is contractor licenses, reciprocal recognition requirements, and the Homeland Defense Infrastructure Reporting and Investigating Bill. None of the big bills that everybody's watching are getting any, well, I can't say they're not getting any attention, but in my mind, he's already made up his mind. He's waiting for the opportune time to slip in that hey, I'm going to veto this, I'm going to do this, whatever. But it doesn't really matter at this point. It's not like the legislature is going to reconvene and override his veto. He's just got to make a call on these 55 bills sitting on his desk.
Watch for Friday evening. I kind of expect a few of them to pop out then, the end of a news cycle.
Well, he's probably waiting for the poll numbers to come in. One big piece of news that came out today, well, it's not exactly out, but we're privy to it, is the budget number is not 10.6, as the CalPie reported, nor is it 11.1, as they reported later. It's actually around 11.5. So $1 billion difference from what the CalPie originally reported. And a lot of that, I mean, that's including general funds and all the legislation that was passed. So it's, Ken, you could probably tell us where to find that on the goldenrod if we had one of those. But it's everything in total, right?
We asked that question directly during the discussion on the thing, and we got six different answers. And part of the reason is there are certain things that they don't put in the budget that are still spending. There are certain things like enterprise funds or whatever that, and then there are others that are double counted. It is the most chaotic pile of BS. But yeah, 11.5, I'm sitting here looking at an email that I got just today from Don Richards, who is the
financial guru.
The fiscal guru for the LSO. And yeah, it says the neighborhood of $11.5 billion. They don't even know.
Isn't that amazing? They can't actually put their finger on how much of our money they've spent.
The standard budget that we started, I was going to say the standard budget, which is what it would take to run government the way that it was last time, was only 8.8. The governor sends one at 11.2. JAC messes around with it for a while, and it's at 11.4. The second JCC comes up, the JCC, the final agreement, is supposed to be at 11.039. But there's also $3.5 billion.
$350,000, right?
There's a lot of little zeros there. No, it's 3.544 billion. $3,544,000,000 that are enterprise funds and other things that I mentioned in there. Anyway, when he gets down to the bottom, it's about $11.5 billion, by far the largest budget ever.
But they'll continue to lie because of the confusion that convoluted. Some of this goes over here, some of this comes from there, you know, and it's a lie. It really is. That's the lie they told in the first and second JCCs was, well, we're not actually increasing or we're not adding a appropriation here. We're transferring it from this fund to this fund. Yeah, but the way that fund you're pulling it out of is set up is it has to be backfilled, which means tax. So the question to the LSO would be, what is the total taxpayer requirement?
Burden. Yeah.
Or, yeah, what's the burden to the taxpayer?
Oh, don't ask whether that it be question. Federal, don't ask that question, because the taxpayer is a freeloader. The minerals pay everything, and then we get a third of what we get off of the cash from our
investments. I didn't say citizen. I said taxpayer. I said taxpayer. Businesses, mineral companies, oil companies, those are still taxpayers. And when they say, oh, that's federal funds, that's still taxpayers. So the question really is, and we'll get down to it eventually, is what is the total taxpayer burden? And I'm going to guess it's a little north of 11.5. Now, remember when we started back in, I don't know, late summer, Gordon's original budget was $9.9 billion. Then he raised it a little. The JAC raised it a little. The first JCC, okay, I'm getting ahead of myself. The Senate had sent back a $10.3 billion budget that undid a lot of those coffee cans and moving money around and say, no, just stop spending money on this, that, and these accounts will no longer exist. And here's your new caps. They fixed a lot of those problems on paper. The first JCC came out at about, I don't know, $10.2 billion, which is still high, but half of what the House was asking for. And you got to believe that it was all planned, this whole mix up with the Senate going off the rails and the JCC needing to be replaced on the Senate side, bringing in the new team. We can get it done in a day, so we look like heroes. The whole plan was to get back to $11.1 to $11.5 billion, and they did it successfully.
They did that, and then some, as you pointed out. There are a lot of things that are still off budget that we just don't know what they're doing. So the true answer is we don't know.
It's just terrifying.
It's a gob.
The lack of respect for taxpayer money is something that you can't understand until you actually go down to Cheyenne and watch them spend your money. You know, I've told a lot of people, like, look, you have no idea how bad it is until you go down there. Even Christine, and I know I've told both you guys this, but I'd like to tell it on the program, is, you know, before we went and watched the session, I asked her, I said, well, do you think I exaggerate on Cowboy State politics? And she says, well, you know, maybe a little bit. And we went and watched a day of the session, and that night we're sitting at dinner, and I said, well, what do you think now? Am I exaggerating? And she says, hell no, it's much worse than what you say.
Yeah. When it's revealed that property taxes over the last few years have gathered in an extra $800 million, and we suggest giving $200 million back to the people.
Yeah.
And they all say, we can't afford it.
What about the $28 billion that's in the bank?
No kidding. It's obscene.
Which we got Tara Nethercott to admit openly on the floor when she was defending how well the Senate usually does with budgets. We've done so well with the taxpayers' money. We have over $27 billion in assets socked away. That's not doing well, but I am going to pull that sound clip because they were proud of themselves.
Yeah.
For how, I don't know, shisty they are when it comes to being able to squeeze every last dime out of hardworking Wyomingites.
Two things out of that. That's $27, $28 billion that are in government savings accounts and not taxpayer savings accounts. And using your broader term, Joey, of taxpayers, that's exactly right. The other side of it is because a large portion of the expense of government is covered by interest off of that money, the taxpayers actually don't feel the full brunt of what we're doing. And so you don't realize the magnitude of what we're actually spending. And I think, and I've said this before, I think if it actually came down to where we had a cash budget and you had to figure out what you're spending money and how much and what for, things would change much more quickly.
The last session, there was Eric Barlow had a bill to do cash-based budgeting, and that thing failed.
Yeah. We're trying to bring that back eventually, but we need a few more votes.
And it was the first thing they killed when they brought in the new Joint Conference Committee was the block grant funding for the university. And that was a stepping stone to getting K through 12 and the community colleges off block grant funding. Yeah, but when Tara Nethercott got in there, her argument was the exact opposite of, we need to keep this because our K through 12 and our, you know, community colleges do it this way. I'm like, you obviously see that we're trying to get away from that and that this works better. And every other department in the government of the state of Wyoming does it this way. But yeah, that was the first thing they killed, was the getting down to the dollars and cents of what goes where and what's spent on who knows.
Which is, this flies in the face of transparency. And that's true all over Cheyenne.
Speaking of transparency, we haven't had a chance to talk about this on Crosstalk, but Ken, how dare you weaponize the process?
I would gladly do it every single time.
So give us the inside baseball on that. Did you guys have that planned ahead of time, or was that something you came up with on the fly? And why don't you just tell us what we're talking about?
Yeah, we basically had it planned. We saw that Dave Zwanitzer had, I don't know, 6, 7 amendments coming on.
You mean Nicholas?
It was Nicholas. Yeah, it's hard to tell the difference.
Pretty much the same.
thanks for keeping me honest there. We saw a bunch of amendments coming to, I believe it was House Bill 109.
Senate File 109. I'm glad I'm paying attention here.
I'm also tired, but that's okay. You guys are too. anyway, it was a gun bill. And gun bills I pay particularly, you can tell, I pay closer attention to. And they began to introduce amendment after amendment after amendment, trying to gut the thing, trying to take all the teeth out of it, trying to change it so that it was meaningless. And we continued to fight back. And each time we stood up to fight back, mostly it was Ben Hornock would stand up and say, you know, and in accordance with 12-4, Rule 12-4, we're going to ask for the ayes and nays. And after he'd done that about a half dozen times, and they refused to debate anything, I got up and I said, what we've got here is failure to communicate, and that's what we're paid to do. And that made a bunch of people angry. And then I said, and when we vote on this, let's just go ahead and do it in accordance with 12-4. And I think that was the last straw.
Yeah, what you said is just say no and let's do it in accordance with.
Yeah, that's right. Just say no and let's do this in accordance with 12-4. And so we're trying to, obviously, allow the people back home to see who's voting what way and who's an obstructionist and who isn't. And there was some objection. Apparently, a particular legislator had had a few too many, because when he looked up into the gallery and saw one person standing up there who was a lobbyist, he said it was three. And which, by the way, if you're not there in the chambers, you don't realize that there are a number of members that are, they call it participating in the sacraments.
Okay, what does that mean?
It means they're drinking their ass off.
Ah, okay, gotcha.
Anyway.
Little blood of Christ for you?
Yeah, well, that blood was probably 0.4 or better. Anyway, not to go down that road one thing at a time. It was Zwanitzer, wasn't it, that stood up and wanted to object and cried about the intimidation, the voter intimidation of having lobbyists stand up in the gallery with clipboards and writing down every vote that they took, and with us weaponizing the system by calling for the vote to be a public vote to be counted each time, and how awful that was. I'm pretty much determined 12-4 is going to be part of every preamble I speak from here on out.
That'd be awesome. They won't let you speak.
Which it's great the way you say that. 12-4 is going to be the preamble, which is exactly the way it should go. That is in the rules. That is part of the process. The rule that Dan Zwanitzer cited when he made the complaint was House Rule 8-5, which is in the book. It's protest against actions of the House.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you can legitimately protest, use a rule to legitimately protest the proper use of a rule.
Also, it wasn't the actions of the House.
Getting arrested for upholding the law.
It wasn't the actions of the House. It was the actions of Representative Hornock and myself. We're the ones that did it. We're not the House.
Yeah. And how ridiculous.
Why do you like to complain?
You know, I mean, the whole thing is so ridiculous anyway. I mean, they're mad because we're going to know how they voted. And because of that, they're forced to vote a certain way, because they know if they vote against it, we're going to beat them about the head and shoulders with it in the next election.
That's how it works.
And let me do a little cover my ass on my statement. I've gotten in a lot of trouble with my dad before making the blood of Christ joke. So sorry for the blasphemy, Pop. And yeah, I'm still doing it. I haven't learned my lesson. But if that was true, I Jesus would have to be Puerto Rican, because it wasn't wine. It was rum. I could smell it in the halls. I'm telling you, until that last couple of days, I did not know that Ember Oakley and Carly Provenza were such untalented dancers. But yeah, get a little in them and they'll shake it on the floor for you. Wow.
Little karaoke action going on there. It's really interesting just to be down there and to see how it goes and to hear the things going on around the side. I remember, you know, Ben Hornock, God love him, he's a tremendous asset for us. And he got up to speak again, and Representative Harshman turns around and under his breath says some of the same complimentary things about Ben that he said about Chuck. Little things like that you miss by watching the video. And I remember having watched the legislature for a long time, being really frustrated that when they came to a roll call vote, you could hear the name being called, but you couldn't hear the vote. And unlike the Senate, where they call back the vote so you know how everybody voted, they don't do that in the House.
Nope.
And so I made it my purpose to every time I vote in the House, I shout my vote. And I tell people, have asked me, why do you do that? And I says, so my mom can hear me.
Precisely right. Well, we did have a couple of gun bills get passed. We don't know if the governor's going to sign them, but we have Senate File 109, which is the repeal gun-free zones bill. There's House Bill 125.
125 was the gun-free zone.
Yeah, excuse me. Yeah. 125 was the gun-free
zone. Eddie Red Flag was 109.
Yep, and then there was the credit card bill. I can't remember which.
Yeah, I don't remember what number that one
was. That was pretty much worthless anyway.
Yeah, it didn't have any real teeth to it, but it's incrementalism. And one thing we proved during this session is we never got in property taxes, we never got what we wanted altogether, but we made some strides in the right direction. And you kind of have to be satisfied with that and come back and run on that and drive it a little bit harder the next time.
Joey, thoughts on gun bills?
Well, I'll tell you, I know a lot of gun bills did as well as they did, not because they're great and necessary, even though I believe a lot of them were good and necessary, but because it's an election year. And this is one of the reasons I've heard they run gun bills in budget sessions. But you got to take a look at the whole picture if you're out there looking at your candidate and say, well, yeah, he said he voted on this. He did vote on this. We've got plenty of audio of Ed Cooper voting for House Bill 125 when it was on the Senate floor. But we have the audio of him also taking every step he could to kill it without being held accountable for it in introduction measures, debate measures, amendment measures. So you need to look at the whole picture because a lot of these candidates are going to come out and say, hey, I'm good on the Second Amendment. Look, I voted for this. I voted for that. Or I'm terribly conservative because I voted for 125 and 109. And, you know, when it came down to it, look at the not very conservative budget that got passed. I know there's two senators out of Rock Springs that are going to have a hard time explaining outside of we got you a brand new high school, how we voted this way almost the entire session on everything. And then when it came down to the budget, we just fell over. Unless they're willing to admit we did it for the high school. Then, they might pick up some posts. But that doesn't equal conservatism.
You just hit something I want to touch on, Vince, we're here. $150 million for a new high school, taking it. There's a program where we prioritize what schools need to be rebuilt according to what they call a Mercer study. And that's the most effective cost of
I can't remember what the acronym is.
Do we have to build a new remedy school? Do we have to build a new school, or maybe could we buy a couple of school buses and move some kids over from an overcrowded school to an undercrowded school? A lot of different options. And what we're supposed to do, according to statute, is go along and study each and every project and determine how it should be prioritized and then work ourselves down the priority. The Mercer study is supposed to be done, and then we allocate money to begin to design and to build or whatever needs to be done according to the study. Well, all those studies, I think it was 2020, the previous studies had been thrown out. They said we're going to start over with that. Anyway, long story short, one of the late budget amendments was to throw in $150 million for a new high school in a district where a key swing vote in the Senate was at play on the budget.
Weird.
Weird is one word. That's probably not the word I would use. Certainly disappointing that something was that flagrant in the process. Ha, gotcha with that. Something was that flagrant in the process, and everybody knew what was going on. And only a few of us raised up a frustration or a little pushback on that. That's what we're up against. people that will do pretty much anything at any cost.
You know that when the CalPi and WyoFile are both stating in, you know, their regular liberal rag garbage, well, it looks like the Senate's going to vote for the budget because these two legislators are now, it was obvious. It wasn't like even the liberal mainstream garbage media wasn't even trying to cover up that fact. They were upfront about it. And if you need further evidence of that, when Ogden Driscoll removed the first joint conference committee and replaced them with the four members, there were two high schools that were guaranteed in this budget, jump the MERS. And by the way, this new plan did not reduce school capital construction for the rest of the Mercer and other stuff. That's still happening. They're just taking more money and putting these two schools ahead on a special budget line item for Teton County and for Sweetwater County, Rock Springs and Jackson.
Yeah.
And the four members of the second joint conference committee picked by Ogden Driscoll were the two senators from Rock Springs and the two senators from Teton County.
And the two biggest problem was two of them are swing votes and the whole thing.
Yeah. If John Kolb and Stacey Jones had continued to vote the way they did most of the session, that final vote on the budget would not have passed. They put them over by one. Otherwise, it would have been 15-15. I think there was one person absent that last day, and they wouldn't have gotten it done.
Yeah, we needed 17 votes.
For them to say the entire session, the traditions of the Senate and the process and the this and the that, and then to get down to it and appoint a freshman, junior, first-term senator to the Joint Conference Committee for the budget tells you everything you need to know.
Well, and one of the reasons they removed Dave Kinski is he's the author of the famous memo that says capital construction doesn't belong in the budget, that it needs to be debated on its own merits. I mean, that's one of the big reasons why, I mean, among others, but that's one of the reasons he got removed off of the conference committee, because he was never going to let one school, let alone two schools, fly in the budget. Yeah.
Well, that and the fact that Kinski, he actually was a negotiator. He heard what they had to say. He checked into all the numbers on what they were saying. He called the lawyers. He had an executive session saying, this is why we can't do it your way, because we're already being sued, and this is another way we're going to get sued. And he still met them halfway. Ogden and his team's concept of negotiation, and Ogden even says this on the floor, hat in hand, go into a room, get ready to bend over and just say yes. And that's all they did in that second joint conference committee that's now costing us $11.5 billion and throwing all of our regular processes out the window. Was they put their hat in their hand, they walked into the room, they bent over and just said yes.
Well, we got the legislative session over. What do you guys see as the big vulnerable races, both for the House and the Senate? And there's a lot of people that have announced their candidacy already. Who do we see as super vulnerable in both chambers?
Well, I know Fred Baldwin said he's not coming back, which opens up that district for Albert Summers, because Albert Summers also said he's not coming back to the House. So Albert Summers is probably going to try to run, and I believe that's Senate District 18 over there in the southwest corner, kind of up through the middle of the state. So you went to Lincoln, Sublette County areas. And I think we could have a pretty good candidate run against him, at least not make it easy for Albert Summers to get into the Senate. But we kind of have the same thing going on over in Cheyenne. I hear Jared Olson is going to be running for the Senate. And these are not vulnerabilities because I think those candidates are weak. I personally don't like them, and I think they can be beat. But because they are now in a position where no matter what, they're leaving a vacuum behind in their House seats, and they could also lose their Senate races. So in those two races, what I really don't want to see is the classic conservative FUBAR move of throwing too many candidates in there. So we need to pack up those areas. My big focus right now, though, is what I'm calling the battle for the bighorns. You know, you got Crago and Western both have opponents right now already. And I think that there's a pretty staunch, the rest of the incumbents are pretty conservative, including, of course, Ken here. So I need to keep an eye on how those races are going and what those candidates are doing. And I think there's a real possibility that, yeah, those two seats, Johnson and Sheridan County, could flip. And then there's a couple of points of interest down there in Natrona County. I think Steve Harshman's very vulnerable.
David Northrup might be.
Northrup might be vulnerable.
Well, there's one race.
Oh, it's Sandy Newsom's not coming back.
Oh, yeah. Sandbags.
Yeah. That's going to be an interesting to watch, one to watch with Nina and Matt going head-to-head there in Cody. That'll be of interest. I've also heard rumors, might as well just go ahead and kick it out there, that Barry Crago might decide he wants to move on over to the Senate. That would put some interesting color into the battle for the Bighorns, as you call it.
Well, I think that would be, I mean, he's going to have a difficult race either way.
Yeah.
But I think with Dave Kinski's performance this session, that he's pretty well guaranteed himself a victory in this next election, if he wants it.
He did a great job this year.
Yeah, and, you know, I've always said that with Dave Kinski, you get 3 years where he's not so conservative, and then there's the one that's right before an election, and some other guy takes over the Kinski suit. But he did a great job this session. I don't really have too many complaints.
And I think with Kinski, he's in a position of seniority to where he's going to run hard this time, because in his second session, so his third and fourth year, if he wins this time, he'll likely be president of the Senate.
Yeah, he's in a really good position. He is a consummate politician. He's very, very good. He knows people everywhere and in every walk. And frankly, I've learned a lot from him. I'm trying to pay attention to people like that and to people like Harshman. How do they operate? How do they do what they do? And I hate to say that, but by learning how they do it, you learn how the game is played, and it's not pretty.
Speaking of playing games, I hear that Kathy Russell is running against Bob Nicholas.
Yes.
Well, now, the question I have is she running against Bob Nicholas in Lander or Bob Nicholas in Cheyenne?
Well, I'll tell you, she's running against him in Cheyenne. I don't know where he's running. In fact, I don't even know if he's running. And I actually know Kathy well enough to where she's running for the seat. She's not going to run against Bob directly.
No.
She's going to run as the better option, the better alternative, and a staunch conservative choice with evidence. Now, his voting record may come into play. But I've known Kathy long enough to where she won't go low. She won't go dirty. She'll point out facts and data, but then just leave it there for the people to decide.
Well, and I have to tell you guys, I was very disappointed by one of our elected representatives. And
I'm sorry.
There's a whole bunch of them. But one in particular, I did not get my annual Bill Henderson comedy short.
Oh, I think you got to stop and take a look at what you're doing here. I speak against this because it kind of reminds me of that fairy tale, Cinderella.
So I didn't get one of those. So I am afraid I'm not going to be able to support.
He didn't give it up like he used to.
I know. I can't support Bill Henderson anymore.
Yeah, there was a few times he was at the podium, just cheese grater to the ears every time he speaks. And there's no sound clip. It's always somebody asking him a very direct and pointed question and him talking about something else over here in the ether. And I mean, he makes a complete ass out of himself, but it's not a concise sound clip like he normally gives us. He normally gives us at least one good goof.
At least one. But we didn't have that. And I told the guy that's running against him, Gary Brown, when the session started, I said, I don't know if I can support you, Gary, because if you win, that means the end of Bill Henderson comedy shorts. And well, Bill did it himself. So now we're going to have to support Gary Brown. Another couple of interesting races. You mentioned the one down there in the southwest corner of the state, Albert Somers' old seat. We've got a pretty good candidate for that. And actually there's pretty good candidates lined up all across the state. And a bunch of them have announced, but you know, there's still some of them that are, you know, for whatever reason, not announcing yet. It's not like the, not like there's a real big secret that they're going to be running, but, you know, it's politics and, you know, there's a little strategy to go along with that. So, Joey, did you see the articles in the Cowpie today?
I glanced over a couple, but by the time I saw Tom Lubnow's name or face for the third time, I was just done with it. And luckily my internet, like I said at the beginning of the show, utility has been a little shoddy here in the Platte Valley today. So I wasn't going to fight the internet, but I saw a couple of op-eds and a few just ridiculous headlines that I didn't really want to get into.
Well, Trotsky Wolfson has a couple of pieces out. One of which pretty much goes after Lori Bratton. Lori Bratton is a candidate running against frat boy Cyrus Western. And that thing, and I'm going to talk about this on Saturday's program, but may as well bring it up now. That thing is chocked full of, I don't know that I would call them lies, but they are definitely inaccuracies about Lori Bratton's record.
Not just about...
Now, I did see some of the comments on that story. Some of the Facebook comments in there. And I remember specifically Half-Tard Rod Miller chimed in and said something about, oh, the Freedom Caucus and real Wyomingites don't want Colorado-type politics up here, yet they're going to bring in Lori Bratton.
Wait a minute.
She's not
where does Cyrus
from
live?
Colorado.
We're not sure where Cyrus lives.
I got a picture of a building in downtown Denver, but I have no confirmation.
Yeah.
But yeah, as far as where Lyndon B. Western really lives, it doesn't matter because he's probably not going to be, with the way Johnson County and Sheridan County politics have been pushing the last few years, he's got a tough race ahead of him. But the comments that I saw about, oh, she's got any connection to Colorado, so that's how we're going to get her. Yeah, that's Colorado politics coming up here. She worked down there for a few years. You know, it's like, of all the things you could legitimately say about me, blaming the fact that I happen to be born in California is the problem. Oh, he's bringing that California stuff. No, I think I've proven I'm not that. So
she can rely on her.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to hear your conversation with her.
She can rely on her record. What was she doing in Colorado? She was trying to keep the state from turning blue against a crap load of money. Guess what's happening in Wyoming right now? Those same nefarious characters are trying to turn Wyoming blue. And she already knows them. She knows the game. She knows the play. She's right where she needs to be. And I thank God she's here, personally.
Well, there's
and
that
I'll
one.
Tell anybody that's got any concerns or questions about Lori Bratton, if you're sitting on the liberal side, you know, Lyndon B. Western, Trotsky Wolfson, Rod Miller, all you goofball rhinos and Republicans that can't spell or Democrats that can't spell, whatever we call the redcoats nowadays, you're lucky it's only Lori, because she's got a daughter that lives here in Carbon County. She's a former chairman of the Carbon County Republican Party. And when Chelsea finally decides to get up and run, you better get up and run.
Yeah,
I'm telling
buddy.
You, Lori, Lori produced a seriously fierce conservative daughter there. And you're lucky it's only Lori that's running and not her kid.
Yeah, or her husband. It's a pretty good family.
We're seeing this across the state. Serious candidates running against people who pretty much showed their ass this session down in Cheyenne. I mean, I said over and over, Joey, I can't remember how many times I said, you and I said on the program, well, this is their last gasp. This is the last bite at the apple they have. So they're going to go big. And, I mean, they did.
Well, I got a great campaign shirt for Lori. She would never accept this, but she's running against Cyrus Western, so I want to make a campaign shirt for Lori that says, the white women are here.
A few people will get that.
Actually, a lot of people in Cyrus's district will get that.
You know, that's something that I have found. A lot of people like Cyrus's dad.
Old Sam Western.
Yeah, even though they know he's a lifelong Democrat. But Cyrus has not been as blessed, in my view, with acceptance and appreciation. And I think that's a tough road for him to hoe. And I'm glad.
Well, guys, we got about
20 minutes. I'll give Cyrus's dad one piece of cover. One piece of cover for Cyrus's dad. At least he's honest. He's a Democrat. He writes this scathing book about Wyoming. and everybody sees it for what it is. All these other people that think like CJ Box is some kind of great Wyomingite Republican conservative, out of their mind. Go check YCFIS and look who CJ Box has given money to and what PACs he's donated to and how he ushered in the lodging tax. You know, just because these guys do things you like, this is why I can't do social media with celebrities anymore, because the amount of movies I can still watch because of who's in them, I got like 6 movies that I'm allowed to watch now. The rest of them, I just can't do it. So I will give him credit where credit is due for being honest about being the piece of crap he is, not just Cyrus's dad.
Fair enough. We're not pulling any punches today, are we?
It might be my last show.
Negative.
I think people are hungry to hear the truth.
I think so. I know they are.
I think they're hungry to hear people be real. There is a kind of an unwritten rule in the House that if somebody is currently seated as a Republican in a particular spot, that you as a fellow Republican don't come out one way or the other during a race. And I have to be cautious with that.
Why?
Because I do have to work with some of these people. But on the other hand, a lot of these up-and-coming folks that are running for various races are friends of mine, people that I have encouraged and that I'm praying they'll come out there to help us.
But see, that's part of the problem, because you're reinforcing incumbency in the House, regardless of...
Well, right now I'm all for it.
Well, right now you're all for it. But what I'm saying is the rule, it reinforces incumbency that just because you happen to be a legislator, then, oh, you can't say anything bad about them. Yeah. By the way, Cyrus has already broken that rule. Thursday before the session even concluded, he was on Sheridan Media talking about Mark Jennings.
Albert Summers, look at all the stuff that he wrote over the interim about many of us on the right.
Right.
It's like the gloves are off.
Well, it's a rule that only applies to you.
Yeah.
It doesn't apply to them. You know, as long as they're in power, you know, anything goes. And that's what we saw during the session. I'm still getting emails from people who wrote complaints about Clark Stith and Cyrus Western. And, I can't include Cyrus on there, but there was Clark Stith, there was Albert Summers, a whole bunch of them. And all of them were summarily dismissed. Well, it's because the people in power are in charge of managing the House. Now, if it were a conservative that did any of the things that we reported on, you guys would be out on your ear.
At least out of your committees, I'll tell you.
What committees?
And honestly, if it's a rule, you started with it's an unwritten rule. Sorry, yeah. I'm not sorry, and I get it. I'm not an elected official, and I'm definitely not you, Ken, but my first statement, hey, Albert, write the rule. Then I'll follow it. Until then, you know where you can, you know, put those lips, because honestly, I've had to walk around that a little bit on the Republican Party side. And eventually I had to stop people and say, you know what? This isn't a rule. There's no rule in our bylaws and there's no law and statute saying the Republican Party can't endorse a candidate. The only law that says anything about the primary is we're not allowed to expend funds on one candidate when there's more than one Republican in a single race. Other than that, we can kind of do whatever we think we can pay for. And the way I got around some of these things was, you know, here's my advice to you, Ken. Lori Bratton is an outstanding conservative, and I hope she does very well in this election. I'd love to see her in the House. Well, what about Cyrus Western? I've met Cyrus. There you're not saying anything negative. You're not endorsing anybody. And, you know, you're just, hey, you're towing the line. The unwritten rule is followed. I think Lori Bratton is an outstanding conservative, and I really would love to see her in the House. What about Cyrus? Well, yeah, I've met Cyrus. And just leave it there.
There you go.
I like that. I like that. And the same thing goes with Mark Jones and Barry Crageo. Yeah, I've met Barry. I have. I didn't meet him halfway either.
Well, there's a whole bunch of them.
But part of the issue there, and I'd like to just touch on this, they're both relative newcomers to Wyoming.
Yes,
and,
they are.
And I say relatively as a person whose family goes back here 5 generations and 146 years, but who's counting? And yet I look at a lot of people who are natives and who have been here for several generations, and politically I wouldn't give a plug nickel for them. I would much rather have somebody who is a political refugee who recognizes what's happening in Wyoming and wants to be here and preserve what little is left to try to be a beacon for the rest of the country and to try to pull us back. I'm all for it. You need to have spent some time here so that you understand the culture and you understand who we are. But these people have both done that, especially the Brattons. When, you know, she mentioned in the show that she did with you today, David, that she came here in 2017. I know that she did because I was there when she got here. They needed a contractor. They called me and asked me to come out and look at the house. Things didn't work out. I didn't end up doing the job. But I met them, was very impressed, especially with their daughter. And you're absolutely right, Joey. That's a tiger there.
Well, I bet if you did a little survey, a little research into everybody that's in the house, I think you'd find a great deal of them were not born in Wyoming. And frankly, I reject that argument anyway, because just because you've been in Wyoming for five generations, that doesn't say anything about you. It says that your parents and your grandparents had pretty good taste because they're here, but it doesn't tell me anything about the candidate. In fact, I think it's just one of those specious arguments that that people throw out there knowing that folks that are from Wyoming, that have lived in Wyoming, want somebody from Wyoming, but it doesn't really say anything about their politics.
I think there's more to it than that, too. If you've only seen things done the Wyoming way, there's a lot you don't know. And one of the best things that ever happened to me was joining the Army and being sent to other places. And I learned both good things and bad things from everywhere that I went, but I learned. And you can come back here and you can look at what's going on here from a little bit different light and understand. And that's one of the things that I appreciate about some of these people. People that have been in Illinois or in Colorado and have seen what went on there have an insight that we here who have not yet really fully seen it play out may not have. And so when you take somebody like Jeanette Ward, I really appreciate where she's been and the fight that she's been through. When you take somebody like a Tom Kelly, and I understand his ability to see what's happening beyond what sometimes we can, I very much appreciate and value that.
Well,
I got to tell you, Ken, I couldn't agree more. Sorry, David, I didn't mean to talk over you again. It's that lag in the service. My show opener every day when I do Just Blame Joey Live is, you know, after a two-decade tour of all these places around the world, realizing Wyoming is the only America has left, that's not just a catchphrase. You know, there's people that have seen stuff all over the country, but some of us have seen stuff all over the world. So not only do we get a sense of what we think our home state should be, but we really get a sense of what's good about America, because you don't have to go very far outside of our borders to see some stuff that you're like, wow, I'm glad we don't have that. But it really is the last great bastion of liberty. And once Wyoming's done, everything else is done. And I don't care how anybody feels about where I come from or how long I've spent anywhere. In fact, if you calculate the most amount of time I've ever spent in an area, I'm more Middle Eastern than anything. But this fifth generation Wyomingite crap's got to go. You know who's a fifth-generation Wyomingite? Joe Barbudo. He doesn't do any good things for Wyoming. He's the chair of the Democrat Party down here. I actually watched one of those documentaries, forensic documentaries today. One of the only serial killers in Wyoming. Finally got caught in 1988. Been a resident of Carbon County for quite a few years now, actually, because we have the prison here. He's a multi-generational Wyomingite. It doesn't automatically say anything about your merit. It might be a bonus. Like for Harriet, it's a bonus. But if Harriet wasn't a fifth generation Wyomingite, she'd still be awesome at everything she does.
I taught a class today, a high school class on government. And we talked about how a bill becomes a law. And one of the questions that came out was, when was the last time Wyoming's government was conservative? And I said, never. I went back to the beginning when we first decided we needed more women. And so the answer was, well, give women the right to vote. It wasn't an altruistic ideal. It was, we need more women, so this is one way to accomplish it.
And we needed statehood. Yeah.
And when you go back, I mentioned, if you go into the House of Representatives, into the chamber over there, there are two posters on the wall of, I think it's the 1913 House of Representatives. Yep. And it was so divided.
It is the 1913.
It was so divided between the Republicans and Democrats that they wouldn't allow their pictures to be put on the same panel. And one of the panels is busted because somebody broke it over the head of somebody else. That's how brutal it was. But you go back and you look from the very beginning, they were Democrats.
Yeah.
I'm the third person to live in my home that has served in the House of Representatives. I'm the first conservative. And that's something that a lot of people don't understand, is that Wyoming really has never been at the legislative level particularly conservative, and it's about to become so.
Well, the history of Wyoming is not a Republican one, like you mentioned, Ken. At our Constitutional Convention, I'm not certain that there was even a Republican there. And if you look at how many governors we've had that have been longtime Democrats, the history of Wyoming's government has not been a conservative one.
No.
And I don't think that the conservatives or even the Republicans have really, well, can't say the Republican part because technically they're in power now, but definitely I don't know that we've ever had a legislature where conservatives have really been in power.
I think we're about to.
I think so too. You know, we've got to
hopefully
win some elections.
And back to the history of Wyoming. Never in Wyoming history did we ever have back-to-back Republican or Democrat governors until Matt Mead and Mark Gordon. And the funny thing is, we didn't have two conservative governors. We had two Democrats that ran as Republicans in a row. So, yeah, we have a very solid history of not standing firm on any principle or party. It's always this mysterious, unwritten Wyoming way, Wyoming solutions to Wyoming problems. And none of it has ever been terribly conservative in the principle, like you said, with suffrage. We went for suffrage because we men were suffering.
Yeah. So Mark Gordon, when he came into office, compared to now, the budget, and I'm saying the last budget because I don't know what's been calculated for the new one, because we still don't know how much it is.
They don't know.
But it's gone up 33%. And look how many times have you heard Mark Gordon is a conservative governor.
There's no facts to back that
no,
up.
No, it's just a bunch of malarkey.
Well, and the truth is, when he put out this budget, there was a long list of adjectives that he used. Businesslike, forward-looking, conservative. And none of those things are true. You know, I've got a little flyer here from Poisonberry Crago.
Please cover that up.
Your opinion matters. A conservative committed to Wyoming. Well, the truth is, Barry Crago is pretty well near the top of this big spenders list. There's nothing conservative about that.
No.
Nothing whatsoever. And his House Bill 45, the one that everybody was talking about, really the only thing it does is sets in stone that your taxes will remain the same and then be increased by 5%. And now they say a possible 5%, but you know, we all know how government works. If there's a possibility, it becomes a reality. Now, if it weren't for the exemption that was passed, that bill would be terrible. But everybody touted it as a conservative solution. The language down there in Cheyenne is truly amazing when you listen to how these people talk.
I don't believe it was his bill either. I think it was given to him because he was in trouble.
Well, he's in trouble, all right.
Anyway.
Joey?
And it's not the only tax bill that passed, and none of the property tax bills, I believe, are permanent solutions. They all have a sundown. I think the longest one runs to 2027, and then we're back to wherever we're at now. And all of these cap bills, I think that's one of the ones we were talking about.
Yeah, 45.
It's so interesting to me because it might get you a little bit of something that looks like a discount this year, but all of the capped evaluation still shows up in the full valuation next year. it doesn't mean your tax bill can't go up more than 3% a year. It means the valuation of your home can't go up more than 3% a year. So yeah. When the actual value of your home goes up, you're only getting 3% off of, you know, that new number, which includes the total value of your home. So the problem we're facing in Wyoming is home values are going up too fast, mostly as a reaction to COVID. And we didn't get any real property tax relief out of this.
Well, and that's probably the biggest point, Joey, is our property tax system as it sits right now is broken. None of the bills that were passed this year really do anything with that. None of them fix the underlying problem. It's just Band-Aids on top of more Band-Aids. And the truth is, until we reform the actual property assessment system, and in my opinion, that happens to be acquisition value, we're not going to have any real reform. It's just going to be additional Band-Aids on top of it.
Yeah, there was no reform. The one bill that came up, and I'll just throw this out here real quick, was Harshman's, what was it, 203?
Yeah, 203.
It came up after we'd actually got there, and they brought it out at the last minute. And the first thing that it did was raise the sales tax 2 cents. And the alternative, the compensation on the other side, was to put $1 million exemption on your property tax. So anybody that had a home value under $1 million wouldn't be taxed. The problem is it didn't get rid of the property tax structure. And so my prediction right off the bat was, well, that the first thing you know, they'll start lowering that exemption value to $700,000, $300,000, or whatever. Second reading, Dan Zwanitzer brings an amendment which passed to drop it to $200,000.
Yep.
Talk about a bait and switch. And yet there are people all over the state, relatively conservatives, who bought into that.
And, all over the state.
Yeah, and it's amazing to me. Even one of my favorite people in the House was saying, yeah, but Steve Harshman promised me. What?
You're listening to Harshman?
I'm stunned at the effect that this had on people. And they thought, here's Harshman, who for over 20 years has been pushing for an income tax, who says we need to have people in Wyoming are freeloaders.
Yeah, incredible.
And somehow they're going to think that there's something good in what he's proposing.
Yeah, there's nothing good in that.
It was stunning.
Well, guys, we've pretty much come to the end of the program. Any parting words?
Bye.
Well, I'm glad to see Ken back, and hopefully we'll get back to doing this on a regular basis. We're going to get a new schedule out for the Independence Network here shortly, so make sure you're tuning in every Monday through Friday, at least 9 till whenever you get sick of us, but keep it playing in the background. And I don't know, we got a little bit of restructuring and planning to do, fellas, so let's get off the air and get into that meeting and make sure we're getting the people what they want to hear. But hey, it is now time for campaign season. I'll tell you, I'm looking forward to it.
It's Crosstalk Live.